Welcome, a listener, to another episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Hummock. This is episode 125 of the podcast, and we have another interesting episode lined up for you. It's just me and Draxneth this week, actually, and it was recorded under somewhat odd circumstances because, of course, I was away the week that I was away from home the week that we recorded this. I was up in northern Alberta in the city of Fort McMurray, and not a good place to find good internet speeds. In fact, one of the best places I could find for internet connectivity was the local pub. Certainly, I wasn't going to be doing any recording from my hotel where I was pulling down an amazing 3 megabits per second at peak, and I gripe about this a whole bunch during the episode, which actually leads us to some interesting conversation to start off with about, you know, internet technology and connectivity woes of yesteryear, and, you know, how at one point in our lives, 3 megabits per second would have seemed like amazingly fast, but now that I can regularly pull like 800 megabits at home, suddenly it seems not even pedestrian, but, you know, positively plodding and slow. How far we've come. Conversation moves on from there. Talk about the differences between Asian countries and North America, where internet technology and its deployment were concerned or have been concerned. Draxneth has some experience in this regard. And then we turn to discussing memory cards and camera technologies, kind of keeping the nostalgia trip going, because of course we've seen a lot of innovation in those spaces too over the last couple of decades. Talk a bit about media conversion from like optical media to, you know, playable video formats on like your PC or some sort of handheld device, virtual dub, daemon tools, stuff that some of you probably haven't used in like a decade come up for mention. I know I remember those tools very fondly. Actually, I still occasionally dip into daemon tools when I'm trying to do recovery operations on some video DVDs. Talk a little bit about that in the episode as well. And then we kind of verge off from there into things like flying cars and old TV series and old movies. Does anybody remember The Explorers? That was a weird one. And end up talking about a Star Wars screen test, and there'll be a link to that in the show notes, a rather fun little thing that I found online actually just the day before we recorded the episode. So, as always, of course, we are hosted now on Anchor.fm, which is a newer and much more social podcast hosting platform. If you're listening to us in the Anchor app, you can, of course, give our episodes applause. You can like the podcast or individual episodes thereof. Please do also consider sharing episodes out of the app to your friends, or alternatively, visit us at spamspamspamhumbug.com and share the episode show note articles there. And as always, this episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug is brought to you by our Patreon backers. Thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and the codex by that means. And if you would like to back the podcast, you can do so. Patreon.com/UltimaCodex is where to go for that. And there's a few reward tiers there. Do feel free to chip a dollar or two into the pot. And as always, a hearty thank you to our co-producers, Seth, Golden Flame, Chris, Brickbat, Dominic, Violation, Cranberry, Christopher, Bruce, Dark Wraith Dragon, Helgriff, Gronk, Pascal, and Thorwan. And now, on with the show. I apologize for the background noise because, yes, I'm the Wi-Fi at my hotel is a bit shit and at best is giving me about 3 megabits, there was a time, I have lived through a time when having a 3 megabit download would have cost you enterprise level dollars and would have been the cat's meow. It would have been the best thing you'd ever experienced. But when I can pull 800 to a gigabit at home on a good day, I'm sorry, it just doesn't happen. No, I'm good, thank you. My dinner just arrived.
I remember back then when the domestic speed, consumer speed were 128 kilobits. 256, 512, and I had a job where our internet connection was 32 megabits.
Ooh, and that's the lap of luxury.
Yeah, and we were working with some Koreans, and the Koreans had from, they were from several universities in Korea, and the link between each university was 10 gigabits.
Wow, that must have been on fiber.
And we were talking about it, and from what we saw, they invested in connectivity and internet and information technology in general more than all of Latin America together.
I'd believe it. I mean, a lot of the Pacific Rim, you know, the Asian countries along the Pacific Rim seem to have gone that route, right? Like Korea, very, very high tech. Definitely a lot of investment in communications infrastructure. Japan is not all that different. I think Taiwan is pretty ahead of the curve too. Versus, yeah, anywhere in the Americas at that time, South America, even North America didn't. I mean, you're probably talking about the days when, you know, I was rocking a 28.8.
Talking about 2005, 2006.
Oh, okay. So a little bit later, I would have been on like a DSL connection, but still, like, you're talking a couple megabits at best, right?
Yeah.
Maybe 10 megabits by then. You know, 10 gigabits would have been beyond any comprehension, let alone aspirational. It would have been beyond any understanding.
Yeah. And one of the campuses had a link of 20, actually.
20 gigabits?
Yeah.
Well, that's impressive even by today's standards.
They were part of an association called Pragma, Pacific Rim Association for Great Middleware Assembly. We were working with the computing grids.
Awesome.
For Computer Center and several others. Korea Institute of Technology and Information. Korea Institute of Science and Technology Information.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think we had really, well, I mean, then again, too, like back in 2005, 2006, I was certainly not doing anything to even put myself near the cutting edge of internet connectivity. I was just out of school and kind of just trying to scrape by on what I could. But still, nothing like that. Nothing like that, I think, was even, you know, within the aspirations of the telco companies around here. Maybe for their highest end business company or customers would you see speeds like that. But I don't even think then that they had anything like that on offer.
Back then, I think the best the ISP were offering in Mexico was 2 megabit. Well, that was top speed back then.
Mm. Yeah, honestly, I couldn't tell you what the top speed I was pulling at the time was. I can't even remember where I was living in 2005, 2006.
Yeah, and at that job, our connectivity to the United States was 32 megabits. And we had connectivity with other campuses in Mexico, and it was 155 megabits.
Which is not a bad speed for that day and age.
It was pretty good.
But still, nothing to compare with. Like, it still floors me that my kids are growing up in a household where, you know, the idle internet speed is around 400 megabits, and the peak is, like I say, in the 800 to gigabit range, depending on conditions. They'll never know what it is to wait for content to load in a browser window. they will never know that unless I, like, deliberately go in and, you know, mess with the QoS settings so that all of a sudden all of their endpoints are at like half a megabit. But why would I do that, right? But like,
yeah, they were born with this.
Yeah, they are the digital natives. And it just, I don't know, it's amazing to me. I mean, having grown up through all of that and having struggled through, you know, issues related to bad connectivity.
300 bauds per second.
Exactly. I'm still, I guess I shouldn't be, but I am still shocked whenever I actually look at what my download speeds are. It just floors me every time. But I guess it's good to, you know, have that memory of what went before so you can kind of, it's in some ways it's really great to wax nostalgic. Oh my gosh, at the place I'm working at, I had to go digging around behind this desk that I was parked at, trying to find another power outlet on the wall because I needed to plug some more stuff in. And I'm looking down and, like, obviously they haven't cleaned behind this desk in years. And why would they? Like, the cubicle's been there probably forever. And then it's pushed up against, you know, the wall. The cleaning staff aren't regularly going in behind there. So I'm looking down, you know, between the desk and the wall, and I'm seeing, like, whoa, there's a parallel cable. Whoa, there's a zip disk. Wow, it's like an archive of forgotten technology back here.
I remember my Spark Cube drive. It was, first I had the zip drive, and I purchased the Spark Cube, which was literally a hard drive. Removable hard drive. It was pretty much like a zip disk, but it was a hard drive. You had the drive, the drive, and you had the removable disk, which you would insert into the drive for reading. They were made of metal. There were those the heads for reading them, and they sounded like a hard drive because it was a hard drive.
Yeah, it was. Just had an odd... It's a hard drive with a really weird form factor. Reminds me of nothing so much as the PDP-11s that I spent one summer programming. And, you know, the hard drives, such as they were rather large platters with a diameter of, you know, a vinyl record and about an inch thick. And you had to, like, twist them into place and lock them.
The Spark U was a little larger than Zip Disk. It was pretty small.
Yeah, I think I vaguely remember it. And I remember, too, like, there were a couple of different kinds of... Actually, one might not have been a Zip... I don't know if they were both called Zip Disks. But, like, I remember there were Zip Disks, and they were about 100... Jazz, thank you. That was the other one. Because Zip Disks were, like, around in the 100 megabyte range, and then the Jazz drives were double that, I think.
The Jazz were 2 gigabytes, I think.
Oh, okay, so even bigger. Yeah, I can't even remember all this stuff.
The Spark was 1 gigabyte, and then iOmega bought the company that made the Spark U and discontinued the Spark U. So the Spark U disk, the price dropped, and I got a few of them for $10.
Which is not bad for that much storage in that day and age.
No.
It's nice to know that even back then, that was the practice, you know. How do you kill off a competitor? Well, just buy them and cancel their product lines. Hi, Fitbit.
Yeah, the Jazz were very expensive. And I remember. The Spark U discs were 40-something, and then they dropped to $10.
Yeah, the Jazz drives. I never had a Jazz drive. I did eventually pick up a Zip drive, but I mean, the technology did not last, did not endure. But for a while there, it was pretty cool.
And then the advent of the SD cards.
Well, you're leaving out a whole history of, like... Sorry, I shouldn't be chewing into the microphone. You're leaving out the whole history of, you know, memory cards in general, where you're getting into stuff like... Because before there was SD, there was MMC, and there was Compact Flash. Compact Flash was ubiquitous for a while. And SD was kind of the plucky young upstart. But, I mean, it very quickly supplanted, or, well, quickly might be the wrong word, but it did eventually supplant Compact Flash, in no small part because of the form factor, right? Like, Compact Flash, I still see Compact Flash a fair bit in industrial settings, because a lot of devices will still use it to store configuration data. And to be fair, Compact Flash is actually really resilient. If you need some kind of hardened, non-volatile storage, Compact Flash is not a bad way to go. But yeah, for consumer applications, SD and its smaller size and the fact that it thus enabled much smaller form factors, it's the king now.
I have a memory card reader with all of those supported.
Yeah, and then they had probably some of the other ones too, like MMC or whatever the heck Sony was doing at the time. Sony had their own spec for the longest time.
And MMC, and there's another one, and then the SD and the micro SD. has four.
I think there was like XD maybe or some things. Because like Fuji was using. I was selling cameras at the time. So like I remember like the Fujis used one kind of memory card and then the Sonys had their own thing. Canon largely had standardized on compact flash. And then SD kind of moved in and supplanted it.
There were cameras with CD writing also.
I had a video camera that actually used miniature DVDs.
I've seen those.
They were all well and good until they didn't properly finalize a video. To this day, I've still not fully recovered my wedding video. I mean, I've got most of it, but the audio and the video continuously get out of alignment. I have to, like, it's a pain in the butt. The tracks just are completely out of sync with each other. So I got to actually spend some time chopping them both up and aligning them. But, you know, even then I didn't have the time. And who has the time now?
I remember back then on the Congress, Richard Stallman gave a conference. And they used a camera that used CDs for recording. And at some point, the CD got corrupted. So they were unable to get the video from the CD. And I told them I was going to recover it. And I did. I recovered the video. Richard Stallman's talk. I had to use video editing tools. I extracted the whole video from the container file it was on, and repaired the video.
Did you ever use Daemon tools?
I have used Diamond tools, but back then I think I used Virtual Dub.
Oh, Virtual Dub! I loved Virtual Dub! Yeah. Oh, I used to use Virtual Dub all the time.
I had to reconvert the video to another format, video and audio streams.
Yeah, Virtual Dub was, well, Virtual Dub was the king for a while of converting like DVD video to anything else usable, MPEG-2 to whatever you needed. I mean, nowadays, Handbrake is kind of the king of that, but before Handbrake, there was Virtual Dub, and man, that was great software. I love Virtual Dub.
Yeah, I used it a lot back then.
Yeah, for sure. I remember that very fondly. I wonder if it's still being maintained. I imagine not, but...
I remember I had some DVDs for instructionals and other stuff. And I converted them all to a format and resolution appropriate for my phone.
Nice.
Yeah, that way I had all the references, videos, and everything available on my phone when I needed them.
For sure. Handy. I mean, I think I mostly use it for, like, converting DVDs to stuff that could just reside on my computer, but... Whatever. Same basic idea. Just, you know, you can take your videos with you and not have to constantly be swapping out DVDs.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I guess I still kind of do today. It's just that now it's, you know, every bit of optical media I bring into the house gets ripped with Handbrake and stuffed on the Plex server, which I can still access externally. You know, me sitting here in this bar, I can access my Plex server at home right now, even though I'm hundreds of kilometers away.
So you have it available through a service or something?
Yeah, if you get Plex Pass, then, like, Plex is free to download and use. Like, you can set up a Plex media server for free, but then if you subscribe to Plex Pass, remote connectivity is one of the features that gets enabled.
Nice.
I think I've talked about it on the podcast before. It's really useful on trips because, you know, all of the different, if we just need the kids to be quiet in the car for an hour or two while we drive, we can give them a device or something. And like literally, like I can just download a movie on the fly and they can watch it. And then, or usually what I'll do is I'll, you know, because I don't like the data charges, I'll download a bunch of movies ahead of time and then they can watch them offline. Cause you know, you can not, I mean, Netflix does something similar, right? Like Netflix allows you to download and cache shows to watch when you're offline. And you can do that with Plex too. And so, you know, I download a handful of movies off of my media server. And then, you know, when I get to the hotel or wherever we're going that night, if there's Wi-Fi, I can swap out any movies. They're like, oh, I don't want to watch that one. How about watch this one instead? Okay, cool. I'll make sure that that's on the phone for tomorrow or whenever I need it next.
It's pretty handy.
It's very handy. And I still can't fully believe that I live in an era where it's even possible.
A lot of things that are happening today, we believe that they weren't possible back then.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's kind of in the realm of not even in your wildest dreams, you know?
Yeah. Have you seen the actual flying cars? They're already a thing and commercially available.
I've heard some mention of them, but I haven't really bothered digging into the news stories, no.
Yeah, there's one that is like, it's like a helicopter.
Yep.
And it already has a pilot and other features. I think it was Liberty. Check. Yeah. PAL-V Liberty.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah. PAL-V is the company's name. And their car is named Liberty.
Interesting. No, I haven't really looked that up. I mean, I guess that was always the joke about, you know, how you know that, you know, what do we have in the future? Well, flying cars. So I guess the future's now. That said, I think I still probably prefer to have wheels for the time being. I'll be an early adopter of some technologies, but large objects that I strap myself into and move at velocity is not in that category.
Okay, it's here. It's $599,000.
Okay, so the price is a little restrictive.
Yeah, and that's the regular version. It includes 150,000 worth of options. And there's the sports car, the sports edition, which is $399,000.
Wow.
Before taxes.
Well, yes. Because, you know, that's the sort of car you get when a Tesla seems too pedestrian.
Yeah, and the one with the extra options includes, says here, dual controls, EFIS, I don't know what that is, power heating, details in hand-laid carbon, in view, exclusive colors and color scheme, exclusive customization options, Italian design and handcrafted interior using premium level materials. Certificate stating that you're one of the 90 PAL-V Liberty owners with a gold-plated copy of the serial number tag.
Yeah, that's
to the event,
the launch event.
Yeah. Right now, it's for the rich, but it's there.
Well, and I mean that's kind of the curve of technology in general, right? CD-ROMs used to cost thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, as you see that uptake in adoption, then, you know, yes, you're bringing in more revenue, but that enables you to open up your production pipelines. And
mm-hmm.
So, like, I get it. I get how it works, but still. I'm not at the point yet where I'm confident that I could strap myself into a vehicle of any size, really, that moved without benefit of wheels, or at least was capable of moving without benefit of wheels, and survive.
And this one is you can drive and you can, but the helix is retractable. And you move some levers and stuff, and then the helix comes out and it's ready for flying.
It all sounds very James Bondy.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, if I have to have any...
There was a movie series about some guy with a very large truck, which was actually... it was a sort of hybrid. It was a large truck, and then the truck container opened, and the car was actually a helicopter. Okay. Road Warriors, or what was it?
It's not ringing any bells. No, I'm thinking now of the James Bond car that I always wanted was the one from For Your Eyes Only, which it was not a flying car. It was an underwater car.
The Highwayman.
Wasn't that a Hugh Grant movie?
Highwaymen. No, not that.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of Lady and the Highwaymen, where Hugh Grant marries his cousin. Not like his actual cousin, but that's the plot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me show you. That's the one.
Let's see here. Whoa, that is a very large... Well, I guess you've just found the do you have a larger version of that? Because that is totally like cover art worthy.
Yeah, actually the one from the TV show was completely black. That one,
well, as you do,
a paint job on it or something.
Yeah, I see that. Huh, that is an interesting looking, I'm going to call it a bus. It's probably not a bus, but it looks like a bus.
Yeah, if you look closely at the cabin, it's a helicopter.
Yes, I suppose the cabin part is helicopterish.
Yeah, and
or is that actually like a helicopter with a very large trailer all around it that it can drive around in?
Yeah, and the helix is folded, and when the container opens, the helix unfolds.
That is just, that's a thing. I don't know what kind of thing it is, but that's a thing. Well, if there's a larger version of that, I'm totally using that as the episode cover art because that's hilarious.
The TV show was called The Highwayman.
The Highwayman. All right, cool. I am going to make a note of that. Man, oh man.
1987.
Yeah. Hmm. Interesting. People driving by here like madmen in the background.
And it's on YouTube, I think. At least a couple episodes.
Cool. I may have to check that out. You know, when I'm not binge watching Avengers Endgame. So, which is downloading right now.
Hmm?
Got to take advantage of this hotspot. I mean, this thing is only pulling 32 megabits per second, so it's still very pedestrian compared to what I got at home. But you know what? When I'm a few hundred kilometers from home and I don't have any other choice, I'll go with what I got. I will take it.
Yeah.
It's faster than 3 megabits. Well, it's been a fun chat, but it seems like it's a quiet night for everybody, so that's all right.
Yeah. Yeah, just watch the trailer, the promo trailer.
for which?
It really feels very 80-ish.
Oh, for the Highwayman. Okay, I'm totally gonna have to look that up now. I mean, I like a bit of 80s nostalgia now and again, but there's the like 80s and then there's 80s. You know, there's there's good 80s and
there's the bad acting 80s.
Yeah. There's a couple of different kinds of 80s.
Exaggerated.
Yep. But that's kind of like everything 80s, right? Like there's
there's 80s music and then there's 80s music. There's 80s movies and then there's 80s movies. But I mean, like, it's funny. Like, I'm trying to think, and you know, for all I know, this may not, but this, the, so we took our kids to the Vermilion Fair. It's my wife's hometown, and they have their county fair every year. And I mean, it's a big agricultural fair mostly. It's an agricultural community, so, you know, of course. But the thing is, like, you know, they bring in, the company is called West Coast Amusements, and they're basically a traveling amusement park, right? They're a traveling amusement park for hire. And so they show up and they set up, you know, all sorts of amusement park rides. And there's a midway, and it's like the one time a year that I'll go and have mini donuts. And but they've got like a lot of the classic rides. There's a carousel and the Ferris wheel and the some of the crazier ones that'll make you puke if you've had too many mini donuts. But but one of the ones that they always seem to have is the Tilt-A-Whirl. And I can never, for the life of me, look at the Tilt-A-Whirl without thinking of the 1985 film, The Explorers. Did you ever see that?
No.
So it's this, it's one of those movies that kind of, I don't know if it was inspired by some of what Steven Spielberg was trying to do, or if it kind of wound up, or it wound up inspiring him a little bit, but it was it's notable for being actually the film debut of Ethan Hawke and of River Phoenix. So, you know, River Phoenix passed away, of course, but, you know, two very well-known names from that era. And Ethan Hawke is still, I think, active as an actor today. Also featured Robert Picardo in a small role. But the whole idea was that, like, basically there's this one kid. So the kid played by Ethan Hawke, he lives in the DC area, and he keeps having this vivid dream about flying over a vast city-like circuit board. You know, it's like, it's a city, but it looks like a circuit board. And he often has this dream after he falls asleep, like watching old sci-fi movies. War of the Worlds features prominently in the plot. And eventually he starts sketching the circuit board and he shows it to his buddy Wolfgang. This is River Phoenix's character, who's like, you know, sort of the typical child geeky prodigy type. And Wolfgang is able to actually build a microchip based on the drawing. And then using the microchip, they're able to create an electromagnetic bubble that, you know, surrounds this small area. And there's something they can do to kind of vary its size. And then, you know, they toy around with it a bit more and discover that the bubble is capable of, you know, like, it's basically, it's you know, the typical sci-fi magical transport technology. It can move basically as far as they need to, as fast as they need to, without the usual ill effects. You know, it's not going to, like, inertia doesn't exist inside the bubble, and it also completely contains an oxygen supply. So they build a spaceship out of an old Tilt-A-Whirl car. And so every time I see the Tilt-A-Whirl, I just can't help but think of The Explorers, because that was one of those movies that I had, like, my parents had taped it off the TV, and I watched it so many times when I was a kid. And I'm sure that if I go back now and watch it, I'm going to be just like, what the heck is this? You know, I'm sure that it probably hasn't aged that well.
I watched that movie.
Yeah, and then, like, there's
the extraterrestrials were...
Yeah, they meet some aliens at the end. Yeah, who stole their dad's car, who were, like, joyriding in their dad's car.
Yeah.
And then dad shows up.
Yeah, with the fists on his head, arms on the head.
Yeah, oh my gosh, yes. It's just... Like, it was so painfully 80s. If I go back and actually think about it now, it's just so painfully 80s. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, I don't know. But, like, just trying to think here, like, okay, so it had Ethan Hawke, River Phoenix, James Cromwell was in it, actually, Robert Picardo, Amanda Peterson. Why do I know that name? What else has she been in? Doogie Howser, maybe that's where I know her from. I don't know. Anyways. Just this it's just a quirky movie. And there's sort of this, you know, it's interesting reading about it on it's kind of the same. I mean, a lot of these 80s movies kind of follow a similar trajectory, right? You know, there's a group of boys or a group of kids, more broadly speaking. And there's, you know, a couple of crushes that maybe get developed across the course of the movie, but they go off and do something and it's some sort of wacky adventure that maybe is kind of dangerous, maybe isn't. We're not really sure. Whether it's aliens or, you know, I mean, the Goonies and the cave and the old, oh my gosh. But yeah, it's just, it's very, like if my memory of it is that it's a very Spielbergian movie, but I'm sure that if I went back and watched it, I wouldn't think of it as such. Still, I mean, like, you know, it was fairly typical for the sci-fi 80s movies of its day, which is to say that, you know, like it's ILM did the effects and, you know, it had fairly significant makeup effects. Joe Dante was the director. What else did he do? I know that name. Let's see. What else has he directed? Small Soldiers, the second Gremlins movie. He's done some stuff on TV too. Oh, he worked on CSI New York. I liked CSI New York. That was good. Of all the CSI shows, that was probably my favorite. But yeah, that's there's your 80s nostalgia right there. Is The Explorers, July 12th, 1985 was the release date. And that's right. They spoke with old movies quotes. That was like their whole thing. It's like they'd basically just been watching Earth and like just learning about Earth through movies and TV signals. And that was kind of a thing like back then, right? It was like, you know, TV signals getting beamed out to space and whatnot. And what were the aliens thinking about us based on that? And it's like literally everything the aliens said to the kids was based on movies. It's just, yeah. Even Battlestar Galactica, the original series ended, not quite ended, but one of the last episodes, one of the better episodes in that whole series, featured them picking up a broadcast of the moon landing, I think. That was kind of more the 70s, but still, like, just that the sci-fi at that time, that was a persistent idea. Oh, just reading the Wikipedia entry. Explorers was a box office flop upon release. It's since attracted a bit of a cult following. but then again, when you release 9 days after Back to the Future, you've got a really hard box office fight ahead of you.
Yeah.
That's right. Oh.
Yeah, and it reminded me, 1978, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Oh my gosh.
1988, Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
I wonder if the release dates were like exactly the same.
Return is April 22nd. 1988, and don't have the release date for Attack. October 20th.
Oh, pity. It would have been cool if they could have gotten the release date to the day. But then 10 years is kind of an odd cycle.
And Return of the Killer Tomatoes is about half of the movie is full of commercials.
Well, that's one way to do filler.
Yeah. It was shamelessly filled with commercials, and when they start doing it, they comment that they ran out of budget and that they had to do it to finish the movie.
Hey, you got to fill up the runtime somehow. Oh my gosh! Actually, speaking of, I saw today on Twitter, Mark Hamill. I don't think he tweeted this out originally, but he commented on it. And it's a video of an extended version of... It's from the screen test for the original Star Wars. And it's basically Hamill and Harrison Ford dialoguing through like an extended version of the dialogue surrounding... like they've just found out Alderaan's been destroyed, but they know they need to get the plans to the rebels. It's just like this extended scene, and it's like it's very like it's from the screen test. So, you know, like obviously this is based, you know, it's everything that's happening in the scene is based on a very early iteration of the Star Wars plot. And of course, you know, in Star Wars, after they find that Alderaan's destroyed, they're almost immediately captured by the Death Star. And there's no indication that that's what would have happened in the scene as they're screen testing it. But I mean, obviously, the story evolves over time. But still, it's just interesting to watch them dialoguing back and forth, especially Hamill. Actually, they're both interesting to watch because, like, Hamill, you can see, like, he seems nervous. He seems a little bit uncomfortable. And he seems to have, like, absolutely no clue what the heck he's even talking about. Right? Like, you can kind of tell he's reading the lines and he's doing all right with the delivery, but you can tell, like, he's, like, you know, probably behind his eyes, he's just thinking, like, what in the heck even is this that I'm saying? Like, you know, Harrison Ford, though, he's already Han Solo. Or maybe it's more correct to say that Han Solo is already Harrison Ford. Because, you know, and he's just going on with the lines, you know, he's saying what he's saying, and he probably has no idea what the hell he's saying either in terms of, you know, where this connects to the overall story of the movie or anything, but he is totally, like, it's Han Solo. It's Han Solo and some guy who is going to be Luke one day. So, fun things.
Ancient footage.
George Clooney was in Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. Oh my gosh. That's hilarious. Well, this proved to be an interesting recording in spite of itself, but I think I'm going to pack it up because unfortunately I, with the client I'm working with, I have a very early start time. So me and my bed need to become acquainted a lot sooner than normal.
Okay. Have a good night.
Yes, you do too. And thanks for making it out. This will be a shorter episode, but hopefully an interesting one for anybody linking it and listening in.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you have a good night. Talk to you later. If you want to participate more directly in the podcast, you can send us an email at ultimacodex@gmail.com, or if you're feeling a bit braver, you can leave us a voice message in one of three places: the podcast website, our Facebook page, or on anchor.fm. You're also welcome to join us on Discord to chat with us and to lurk or contribute to podcast recordings when they happen. If you want to join the Ultimate Dragons, you can do so at udic.org, where you can choose your very own dragon name. You can also find the Ultimate Dragons on Facebook and on Google+. You can follow at Ultimate Dragons on Twitter, or join them on Slack or Discord. And if you're feeling really old school, you can even fire up a Telnet client and check out the Wearmount. If you'd like to support Spam 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 Humbug, you can do so at Patreon, where for as little as $1 a month, you can get access to episodes the day before they go live for everyone else. You'll also get access to behind-the-scenes audio on occasion, and possibly other interesting content. But if a monthly subscription isn't your thing, you can always buy your video games at GOG. We are a partner of that fine site, and every time you buy one or more games at GOG via the links on our websites or in the show notes, that helps us out. But we also welcome your moral support. You can like the Ultima series on Facebook, follow at Ultima Codex on Twitter, or leave the podcast a review on iTunes. And you're welcome to share our episodes with your friends and social media circles. Spam 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 Humbug is a production of the Ultima Codex. You can find show notes online at spamspamspamhumbug.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, be virtuous.